test is good. The AMSR's grid works good. Just if you notice any change in your vision, say if you wake up one morning and your visual field is like black or half of it's black, you have a severe problem going on.
Okay.
So any change in your normal vision, you should definitely call an ophthalmologist and have them examine your eyes. They're real good at diagnosing problems, but it's the way they go about working with them is where we come in. And Dr. Banker did 20 years of research and study on eye diseases and eye problems and what's causing them and what to do about them. I mean, she was an eye specialist, and she did research on this.
And you've been working with her for many years. Now, Dr. Banker has passed away, and you're continuing
the
legacy.
Yeah, she died in May 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And before she did, she told me that if I wanted to continue the work and the practice, since I knew how to do it, Jeannie Mainzer works with me, and she's a certified kinesiologist.
And we're actually out of time, unfortunately, right. John. I wasn't watching the clock. And,
all right.
But no, I want to give your phone number that you want people to contact you.
Yeah, we're selling tickets at Eventbrite. There's a link on our homepage for the lecture, drbanker.com. And if anybody wants to call me, the office number in Boulder is 303-494-4532.
Say that again.
303-494-4532, drbanker.com. The number's on the website. And I'm here Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mountain Time.
Okay, got to run, John. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Kathy.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye.
And that's for August 9th lecture at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. You've been listening to Health Action. Stay tuned for Jim Freund and Hour of the Wolf. This is Nawang Ketchog, Music is Medicine.
Oh, Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Our guest this morning, via recorded interview from about 2 years ago, a rebroadcast actually, Linda Nagata, one of the greats. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It's a question of tone for me. I don't think it's particularly hard to mistake Bong Joon-ho's newest film, Okja, now running on Netflix, for a Spielbergian child's adventure fantasy, with a young Korean girl, Mija, played by An Jo-hyun, having her immense roly-poly, quasi-hippopotamus-like, and surprisingly adorable, quote-unquote, super pig, the titular Okja, stolen away from her by an evil, multinational agri-corporation with the intent of introducing the world to the wonders of Okja sausage, among other foodstuffs. There are beautiful and amusing forest-bound pastoral sequences. Can you use pastoral for a forest setting? At the beginning of the film, with a truly gripping moment of peril that demonstrates both the bond between girl and super pig and the inherent intelligence of the lumbering beast. There's a fantastically mounted chase scene through the city of Seoul between a tractor-trailer truck loaded with Okja and another piloted by PETA-like activists led by Paul Dano, intent on rescuing the creature. And not to be too spoilery about it, but there is a happy ending that reunites Mija and Okja and delivers the message that families come in many unconventional forms. But the liberal invocation of the F word throughout the film is one indication that this isn't really meant for kids. Another is when Dano brutally beats a member of his organization for having lied to him. And while it's no surprise that the final act features Mija's horrific visit to a super pig processing plant, the intensity of the sequence edges closer to the showers sequence from Schindler's List than the government incursion from E.T. We're out of the realm of wonder here and into some truly dark stuff. And this has been a problem with me, with director Bong Joon-ho, particularly in his previous film, Snowpiercer. An uneasy fit between a fanciful mise-en-scene and an unsparing attitude towards a story's darker aspects. It's especially notable in the sculpting of his villains. Here, a pair of twin industrialists, played by Tilda Swinton, and an idiosyncratic and self-absorbed zoologist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. Both actors manage to push boundaries in terms of scenery chewing, but Gyllenhaal takes the prize in a truly unpleasant sequence in which he unleashes a variety of tortures upon the helpless Okja. I don't particularly blame the actors. From my experience with Snowpiercer, this is clearly what Joon-ho wants. But in such company, I was grateful for Giancarlo Esposito's relatively restrained presence as a Machiavellian second-in-command. I am willing to admit personal weakness here. Tons of praise was heaped upon Snowpiercer, and likely Okja is in store for the same. Whatever people are sinking into in Joon-ho's storytelling style, that stuff, the operatic performances, the dance between whimsy and cynicism, there's a massive public event, or it's suggested it's massive, to greet Okja's arrival in New York that looks nothing like a thing that would be staged in America. That stuff just naturally grates on me. And it's not like I don't appreciate black humor or introducing real-world consequences into otherwise light fantasy, but it isn't working for me here. I can't say that Bong Joon-ho doesn't know what he's doing, and certainly the quality of the film, his commitment to the world he's building, and the story he's telling cannot be denied. I'm left wanting to praise Okja, and stymied by a style that keeps me from doing so wholeheartedly. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And thank you, Dan. Yeah, I watched the trailer for Okja earlier tonight, as a matter of fact, and I have to say, you know, it really does sound interesting. And when you realize that this is, well, it looks offhand like a family-friendly kind of movie, and then you realize that this comes from the same person who made Snowpiercer. Now, I've got to tell you, Snowpiercer sounds like a fascinating film. I might well enjoy it if it wasn't for the extreme gore. And I am not a fan of extreme gore at all. It keeps me, it stops me from wanting to see certain films, because if the image, pardon me while I'm trying to plug a flash drive in, I was using one computer and that wasn't working, so now I'm going for another, and I can never find where the flash drive insert is on computer one, assuming it's computer one that I want, which I think it is. There we are. Alrighty. So, now see if I can... So I am switched over there. So I'm probably... This is Win 10. I have to tell you, I'm not a Win 10 person. I am a Win 7 type. So, since it But there are nice things in Win 10. And one of them is when you put something in the machine, it automatically pops up. Since it hasn't done so here, I'm obviously on the wrong machine. So I probably want computer 2. Okay, plug in there. Did anything happen? Did it bounce up anything? No. Oh, yes, it did. Yes, it did. Thank you very much. Now I can conduct a search and find the interview that we are going to hear this morning. Oh, it worked. It worked. Hallelujah. Okay. I'm just going to copy that over to the desktop. Because we have a really great interview for you this morning. But first, yeah, there's always a but first. But first, okay, I'm on Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, and I run a reading series, as you may well know, called the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and it's on Tuesdays. So usually on Wednesday night, Thursday mornings, I have to sort of, you know, become either A, unstuck in time and go back and say, boy, you just missed a wonderful thing. But on this one rare occasion, I can tell you, we didn't do our reading on the first Tuesday of the month because first Tuesday was July 4th. And it would be ridiculous, ridiculous to think that too many people, including the readers, would show up for that. Yes, the other thing that would be good if I did, you know, forget the flash drive. Let's walk over here and pull out the sheet of paper. Yes, paper. Paper that I wrote notes on. Pen and paper, my PAP. Or as, you know that there are these things called PDAs, personal digital assistants. I have a PAD. It's a notepad. Okay, tomorrow. Once upon a time, actually, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings has just finished its 26th season. And but we're in a summer series. There is one reading tonight, and there will be one on August 1st. The one on August 1st, I will just mention, is Carlos Hernandez and C.S.E. Cooney, C-O-O-N-E-Y, author of Bone Swans, Claire Cooney, if you like, if you happen to be a person who listens to a lot of audiobooks. She's a voice person, not with the people with whom I work, but with Tantor, I believe, is the name of the company. But this month is different. Okay, 2 months ago, we had all these various people from a publishing platform called Serial Box. The idea is that one person writes the beginnings of a novel, creates what they would call in a writer's room for television or something like that, they would call it the Bible, right? Star Trek had a Bible, this has a Bible, and so forth. Well, Serial Box has currently 4, about to be 5 serials running, and then different writers come in and write parts of that and all that. And so we did a Serial Box Spectacular. Now, Flash, and Amy Goldschlager produced that, by the way, I should mention. So I asked for the first of our summer series, former curator of the reading series, Paul Witkover, if he would care to read from his fiction. And since he's a former curator, why doesn't he just curate the July 6th event and choose his second reader? Well, wouldn't you know that Paul, and I wasn't really fully aware of this, was one of the writers in the Tremontaine series, which is devised by Ellen Kushner. And he invited Rescheline Maltese to be his co-reader, who, by coincidence, is also in Tremontaine. So we're having another cereal box evening. It wasn't designed to be that way, and the other one before was six people, and this one is two people, but it did work out. So Paul Witgover is the author of five novels, including most recently The Watchman of Eternity. He has been a contributing writer on all three seasons of the serial novel Tremontaine at SerialBox.com. He has been a finalist for the Nebula, World Fantasy, Shirley Jackson, and Locus Awards, and his first novel, Waking Beauty, was shortlisted for the Tiptree Award. Rescheline Maltese can fly a plane, sail a boat, ride a horse, but has no idea how to drive a car. With Erin McCrae, she writes romances about fame, public life, and other forms of witchcraft. Their most recent novel, A Queen from the North, is a contemporary royal romance about magic and marriage in a not-so-united kingdom where the Wars of the Roses have never ended. Rescheline is also a writer and producer on Serial Box Publishing's Tremontaine. Well, there we go. So, that's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, admission free. Where? Here. 388 Atlantic Avenue, ground floor. I suggest, since we hope to start at 7 o'clock, you show up at about 6:30, and that way you can get a bite to eat or a beverage from the cafe, and then take your table or seat and enjoy yourself. Get ready. Meet the other people who are there. We usually have a very nice crowd of folk. If you are out of the visiting range, you can watch it on live stream. What you do is you go on to livestream.com, and then it says, you know, are you going to broadcast? Are you going to watch? Well, you're going to watch. So you go to watch, and then you search NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, NYRSF, and you will find the various readings we have done, including the one coming up tomorrow at 7. In fact, if you go there now and click on it, it will send your phone or browser device or whatever a reminder when we are about to go live. So, again, tomorrow o'clock, free admission, donations, very much accepted, and we have a suggested donation, but we never turn anybody away for lack of funds. Believe me, I'm not sure that I could, at this time, make such a donation myself. But, so we do recognize the issues here, and we would rather have you come than, well, then not come. It's that simple. So, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. For more information, if you are on Facebook, go join the NYRSF group, NYRSF readings group, or go to my page, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. I don't believe you have to friend me to see the things that I list there. Also, there's a group called WBAI Radio, and it is listed there, no question about it. So, any number of places you can find further and more information about the reading tomorrow, and I do hope you can make it. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Now, while I have been gabbling away, I had every intention of pulling up something that I had written online. Reading from paper, as I just was. And, of course, I didn't do it. So I'm doing it now. Do-do-do. Mm-hmm. Very interesting tabs that other people have up on this computer. And I am beginning to wonder if this computer is, in fact, working. I am definitely getting off Firefox and going to Chrome. I am not a fan of Firefox, I must say. So come on, there's, did Chrome come up? It's lit, there we are, thank you. But, yes, okay, and it is in fact logging in. So, now I can do this thing. Because I wanted to read some biographical material. It is possible, if you don't read a lot of good and hard, often hard science fiction, that you do not know Linda Nagata. But she writes wonderful short stories and novels. It's not just hard science fiction. She's all over the place. But she's written a nanotech book. She has possibly the definitive nanotech book in some ways. Nevertheless, her stuff really has to do with characters and short stories. Her latest novel is called The Last Good Man, which is a near future thriller. And I have not yet read it, but I know how good she is. And gotta tell you that should definitely catch up with her work. So, she came to New York, not something she does commonly, just shy of 2 years ago. And part of the reason for that is that she lives in Hawaii, and that does not make for an easy commute. So we are very, very glad to have her there, and I recorded her at an alternate studio, as it were, in Brooklyn. And I guess without any further ado, I will play that for you. So I am now recording, and the first thing that I will do is slate it, as it were, by saying the date, which, I have to look at my phone to figure out, but I know it's a Thursday afternoon, and it's September 24th of 2015, and I am talking with Linda Nagata, who is somebody who I have read for many years and enjoyed a great deal. I have read most of the nanotech material. I have not read your fantasy, which I really should.
Yes, you should.
And I have not yet read Red. But we're going to talk. No, I'm sorry. I read the first book.
Okay.
But I have not read the subsequent two because I didn't even realize that was going to be a trilogy. Mm-hmm. And I've had the pleasure of working on two audio podcasts out of three that were done for Lightspeed and had a lot of fun with one of them making walkie-talkie sounds for one of the characters. Your first, you should be talking, you should be telling us, but your first novel got the Locus Award?
Locus Award for Best First Novel. That was The Boar Maker way back when.
Boar as in B-O-H-R.
B-O-H-R.
Yeah, yes. For those not looking at their radios. And yeah, I actually read that at the time. It was a while ago.
Well,
it's time to reread. And I have a collection of books in the basement that is frightening to even try to approach. Books are vaguely alphabetical, but then you have to climb over things to get to them. Otherwise, I'd have them all up here for you to autograph.
Oh, well, next time maybe.
Yeah, I hope so. But you don't get here often. You live in Maui.
I live in Maui. So we left an island in the far west of the country and came to an island in the far east of the country.
Yeah, a long one,
yes,
to be precise. Brooklyn and Queens are both part of Long Island. Mm-hmm. So New York is really a city of islands, more or less. How often do you get here?
This is my third trip ever.
Ever. Okay.
Yes.
And arriving the same day as the Pope.
We will be in Manhattan on the same day as the Pope.
Oh, yes. Good luck.
Thank you. We will need it.
Yeah, yes. Public transportation is being advised.
Oh, absolutely.
For that, and there is a bus that goes from here to there, but I think subway, unfortunately, will be the better plan.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. How does living in Hawaii, you're not the only nanotech science fiction writer living in Hawaii. Didn't Kathy Gunin move there?
No, she lived there for a time. I know as a child, I believe.
Right.
But no, she lives
there. Then she went to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's still in Florida.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought she moved. She makes it here more often. I see her more often. But I do think, well, there aren't that many women nanotech writers who hail from Hawaii, are there?
Well, definitely not too many who hail from Hawaii, but actually, the nanotech books were quite a while ago, though.
They were
in the 90s.
They were, and they sort of foresaw a trend that came after that, I would say. I think other people have since then discovered it. And then you also turned to, there's a lot of military science fiction in your writing.
Well, that's actually very new. What I've noticed is people say, oh, you write military science fiction, and I actually have only been doing it for the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a new thing for me. And it started off with this the novel, which I called The Red First Light.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that and self-published that in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason I self-published it was because I didn't think I would really be able to sell it, because it's hard science fiction written by a woman in first person from a man's point of view, in military science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like it had too many strikes against it. So.
Yeah, but it's done well.
It's done well. It became the first self-published novel to be nominated for a Nebula Award. And it was nominated for the Campbell Memorial Award and went on to sell to Saga Press, Simon & Schuster.
Yeah.
Along with the two sequels.
Is that Joe Monte's imprint?
It is Joe Monte's imprint, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it was republished this past summer under the title The Red.
Okay.
And the second book in the trilogy was published last month, August, and the third book will be out in November.
Excellent.
So three books in less than 6 months.
So when you wrote the first book, did you know there would be a trilogy?
I knew there would be two books.
Okay. But now there are three.
Now there are three, yes.
Okay.
Three seemed a nice round number. The story played out that way. People have asked me, well, did you plan to write a trilogy? And my answer to that is usually, ha, 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 ha.
Right, exactly.
Plan? What is this word, plan?
Yeah, well, yeah. I have interviewed people who have fibbed about how many books they knew they were going to do as they were encouraged to spread them out. Mm. And Roger Zelazny never fibbed. He said, nope, nope, nope. Amber was a trilogy. It was always going to be a trilogy until the publisher said, no, we want five. And then another five. So he was always forthright about that. When did you start writing? And were you writing speculative of any kind? Because you've done it all, pretty much.
Well, I started writing. It never occurred to me to be a writer until my last year of college. And then I was majoring in biology.
Mm-hmm.
And it just decided, well, you know what? I think I'd really like to be a writer. So it took me about, 5 years at least. I think it was at least 5 years. And I finally managed to sell a short story to Analog.
Mm-hmm. That's not bad, 5 years to first publication.
It's not too bad.
Yeah. Did you have an agent?
Not at that time. After I'd sold three short stories.
Then
I was able to get an agent.
Okay.
And which is, people have asked me over the years since, how do you get an agent? And I have no idea. My impression is it's much, much harder now than it was back then.
It is harder now, and short stories will usually not be the way in. Although, in some ways, it's getting easier. In some ways, as publishing changes, as people can self-publish or create their own imprints, as it were, Kelly Link was able to be a huge success with everything she did was technically self-published and has gone quite far with it.
Well, it's a great option to have.
And online. The magazines that were always the digests, mm-hmm. which is what I cut my teeth on, Galaxy and FNSF and all of those. Now we have Clark's World and Lightspeed and, there have to be more.
Well, those are two of the big ones, definitely.
Yeah, there are.
It's, from a writer's point of view, it's very handy to have the stories online because it's easy to point them out to people and say, go take a look at this. This is another story, in the story world of whatever novel you want to name. And it's just, it's an easy way to promote your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to have links mm-hmm. to them. It's also an easy way for voters to access them and say, oh, that there it is. And they can always find it and pick it up and go back. At Lightspeed Magazine, you've had a couple of podcasts done. Have you done more audiobooks than that?
The Red is my first novel that's in audio.
It is?
Yes.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. So Simon Schuster produced that, I assume.
No, Audible did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And was that with you or through Simon & Schuster?
That was a separate agreement, so it was sold separately.
Oh, very good.
Yes.
Very good. Congratulations mm-hmm. on
Thank
that.
You.
Did you like it?
I did. And the funny thing
was... I'm very audio-oriented, yeah. obviously.
I'd never really listened to audiobooks before. Mm-hmm. I've listened to the Lightspeed podcast, but as for full-length novels, I never had. And so I listened to that one, and honestly, I'm hooked. I've listened to three or four novels since then, mm-hmm. and I really enjoy it because it's something to keep the brain busy while doing tasks that don't require a lot of thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it's hands-free mm-hmm. kind of stuff, great for drives.
Exactly.
And things like that. Mm-hmm. Does your fiction seem different to you when you hear somebody else read it?
It doesn't seem a lot different. I notice there's parts where, if I were reading it, I would emphasize things slightly differently. I've noticed with two or three of the novels that I've listened to, sometimes it seems like the male narrator will make the women characters not sound the way that I would hear them.
Yeah.
They sound generally have a little bit of more of a submissive or a questioning tone in the way that they deliver them, which I found pretty interesting because this has been more than one narrator.
And, yeah. But what's coming into existence more are multi-voice audiobooks, mm-hmm. full cast, as they call them. So you may have a male narrator, but the female characters will often be females. Mm-hmm. And on the two podcasts I worked with yours, one was male, one was female. Roxanne Hernandez read one of your stories.
Okay, but that was, I think that was Nightside on Callisto then. That must have been the first one, because that was the one that had a woman reading it.
Okay, yeah, except I didn't edit that one.
Okay.
And one of the ones, but it doesn't matter. We should talk more about your writing, because we just had you selling your first short story 5 years after...
I decided on this brilliant career, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was a career choice, not just that you were going to be writing, but that you would be a writer.
I recall it being that way, yes.
Yeah.
I can't imagine at this point in time the cockiness that it must take to say, well, I've majored in biology, but now I'm going to become a writer.
It's,
that's pretty much how it was. Yeah.
How much did your background in biology inform your writing?
It was very helpful, because I like to write at the harder end of the science fiction spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me background knowledge, and it gave me a way to think about things, especially with the nanotechnology books. If you look at biology at the molecular level, there's a lot going on there, which is very suggestive of things that could be going on. And so I would tend to look at my books from that direction instead of the very hard mechanical side. It would be more the evolved and developing side. So it definitely helped me out in the early books.
Mm-hmm. And how did you transition from short stories to novels?
Well, I didn't really. The first thing I ever sat down to write was a novel.
Okay.
And I wrote that, and I think I rewrote it, and then I decided maybe I should try short stories instead.
Hmm.
So I went on and worked on short stories for a while.
Well, now we're going to get to my favorite question,
mm-hmm.
Which is about the different forms.
Okay.
Long form versus short form. How different are they for you?
I think for me, my short fiction is not that different from novels, in that I tend to structure it in much the same way. We have somebody with a problem that they have to deal with, and they either solve the problem or they don't. I think a lot of short fiction is more structured. It approaches things more, maybe more circuitously. It's not that kind of straight line challenge and succeed or fail plot, whereas mine tend to be plotted that way.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's fairly similar. It's just a lot shorter and obviously a lot less different plot threads running at the same time.
Was it your science background that led you towards the hard science fiction spectrum at first?
I think it's just what I was reading a lot of at the time.
Okay, which opens up, what were you reading?
A lot of science fiction.
Yeah. I mean,
I get that, I got it from my dad, really. He was a great reader of mm-hmm. many different things. But I would pick up the books that he had, and that's really, I think, how I got into it. But any sort of adventure fiction was what I liked.
Yeah.
It could be set on Earth. It could be set somewhere else.
I would say almost everything that I've, or everything that I've read of yours, is pretty much an adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
I think whether we're talking the nano books, the military books, as I said, I haven't read the fantasy, but I've read of them. They're all adventure-based.
Yes, yes. That's what I tell people. I'm basically, I write adventure stories. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what informs that, if I may? That's a stupid question.
Why is that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, because not everybody is doing that, and it's mm-hmm. not the form that a lot of writers are taking right now. They write pastiches, they write more. They are adventurous without their stories being adventures mm-hmm. very often.
I can remember being like elementary school age, and I would go to the library and I'd look at the bookshelves, and it would be like a book about, oh, my parents are getting a divorce, or my grandmother's sick, and I would just go, no, so-and-so gets lost in the wilderness. Yep, that one will do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who were the writers that helped launch you?
This is one of the hardest questions for me, because all of that is just like faded into the history. I do know that I read a lot of Andrew Norton growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Farley. I love the Black Stallion books.
Oh, okay. I only read the first.
And getting a little older, I remember reading Frank Herbert, Dune books. Mm-hmm. Just many other things that I cannot list the names for you.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. It's useful often for listeners because my assumption is that this is not, it may end up becoming a podcast, but this is broadcast. This is for the great unwashed. This is for people, you know, late at night in the donut shops as well. They may not know that much about science fiction. So I love to name names and name books and things like that. And also given, people can download it and hear the show pretty much any time for it. Several months after broadcast, but outside of that, those people are probably looking for something science fiction oriented. Mm-hmm. But my assumption, broadcasting in New York to a potential huge audience,
right.
I make no assumptions that they know even who Frank Herbert may be or some of these folks. So I love to name such names when I can.
Okay.
But the name at hand is Linda Nagata. And by the way, we should spell that for listeners. N-A-G-A-T-A.
Correct. A very easy to spell name.
Yeah. And at some point, you moved from novel to short story. Various adventure types, and then somehow, somewhere, you made a move toward fantasy.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I wrote science fiction for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
This is through the 90s up until about 2003.
Your first book being what, 85?
First novel was 95.
95, okay.
Yeah. And then 2003. And that was Memory. That was from Tor. The book's name was Memory.
Yes.
And that was my...
That made quite the splash, that book. I remember reading it, and I remember actually dropping by Tor at the time and seeing David Hartwell and a few people. And this was the book they were all, like, holding up and saying, "Read this, Jim."
Were they? I never heard any of that.
Well, you just did, I guess.
I guess so.
Yeah. I just remember that very clearly because they gave me a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one I would love to get autographed if I could find. But anyway.
Anyway. That was pretty much the end of my, what I call my first career, Memory. That was it. It didn't sell too well. I just kind of felt a little bit lost at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I had recently gotten a full-time job. I had teenage kids and aging parents, and there just wasn't a lot of room or inspiration for writing anymore. So I basically stopped writing for a number of years. And then circa 2010, I decided to take it up again. This is when I started hearing about self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to do something entirely different from what I'd done before. And so I sat down and I wrote these two little fantasy novels, which I call the Puzzle Lands books. The first one is called The Dreadhammer. The second one is called Heppen the Watcher. And they're somewhat grimdark.
Mm-hmm.
They're very short. They're very fast-paced.
I'm going to have to read them now. They were originally published under a pseudonym, weren't they?
The first one was.
Okay.
Yes, I decided to try a different name. That didn't work very well. So I just decided, forget this. I'll just put it all under my own name. So I actually republished it. Which, by the way, is one of the advantages of self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
If you change your mind, you just get to change the book. You don't have to get anybody's permission to do it.
There was a time when self-publishing was, I won't say frowned upon, it was a nasty thing. It was vanity press. It meant that the person wasn't good enough to get an editor to say, okay, do this. And that is something that has very much changed in the views of the gods who give out awards.
Well, I think that it has changed somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
It's still doesn't seem to have a great reputation among a lot of people. What I found with The Red when I published that, despite the fact that I have a Nebula Award, a Locus Award, that I've been multiply published in different short fiction markets, I could not get the book reviewed at most places.
Wow.
They were not interested. Now, ironically, I could get it reviewed at the bigger places. Locus reviewed it.
Okay.
Tor.com ran a review of it.
Well, those are actually...
Those are great places
to be reviewed. Yeah, those are great places to be reviewed, yes.
But I found it rather ironic that smaller review sites wanted nothing to do with it. So what I have found since then is, you know, it's been looked at by a lot more places in its Saga Press edition. You know, and it's understandable. The vast quantity of books that are self-published, you know, some of them are very, very, very good. I mean, The Martian is coming out as a movie very shortly here.
Right.
And that was originally a self-published book.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the question comes up, how do you pick out the ones that are good to read as opposed to...
What's the chaff?
Right, right. And... I don't know. Discovery is the biggest question, whether you're traditionally or self-published.
It's often an issue because I get a lot of press releases, 20, 30 a day, easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say of those 20 or 30, 15 of those have to be self-published.
Mm-hmm.
And I can actually usually often tell by the quality of the press release. not just the number of typos, but the language that people will use. And that's, for me, actually a very good way to tell. And I can be wrong. I have made discoveries of, oh my, this isn't bad at all. And I've also made discoveries of, well, that was somebody who, had something to say, and they said it. They need to learn how to say it a little better, perhaps.
Well, a good editor is very, very valuable.
And that was the question I was going to ask next. How do you get your work edited when you self-publish?
Well, for the first book, The Dreadhammer, I will admit, I did not have an editor on that book.
Okay.
Okay, so the second book, I had an editor go over it. That's Heppen the Watcher. And that was a fairly brief edit, I guess. There weren't a lot of changes that were made from it.
Okay.
Did
you hire that editor?
I did, yes.
Okay.
And then with The Red, that was kind of an interesting story. I had the manuscript, a draft done that I had sent to beta readers, and I probably had 4 or 5 beta readers go over it. And they all made some minor suggestions, and none of them made the same suggestion. And I thought, okay, I'm doing okay here. And I did those little fixes. And then I asked Judith Tarr to edit this book for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent the book off to her, and she wrote me an editorial letter, and it had 700-something comments.
Oh, my.
In the manuscript, in the Word manuscript. And I thought, oh no, this book is going to be a complete disaster.
But she, she wouldn't have given you 700 comments if she didn't find it worthwhile.
I sent her a whiny email, and she was my hired editor now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you just don't like this book. No, I do like this book. It's very good.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally corralled my ego, shut it up in the barn, and sat down and got to work. Mm-hmm. And I think I wound up adding 5,000 words at least to the manuscript, and vastly improved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And Judith has gone over the 2 sequels as well. So that's Judith Tarr.
Yeah, and who herself is a very,
very
good writer.
Very good writer.
Yeah.
Yep, and a very good editor.
Yeah, T-A-R-R for again, people not watching their radios.
That's right.
So
And these are the books that are coming out from Saga?
Yes.
Okay.
Which so is... the thing the with the series, I had been literally on the verge of publishing the second book. I had been about a week and a half away of publishing the second book when it was the series was on auction. And Joe Monte had, through my agent, requested that I withhold publishing the second book.
Ooh.
That's how close we were.
Wow.
So that one had been ready to go at the time, which is the reason, of course, that we've been able to publish all three books this year in a short time span.
And I as a reader, I'm always very happy when that happens. I think the classic examples would be Philip Jose Farmer or Michael Moorcock, both people who sometimes wouldn't even finish series. And you would read a book and now it's 2.5 years for the next edition to come out, and God forbid one of these people and both of them would end books on cliffhangers. And so I would read book one, wait 1.5 years, book two has come out, but I have to reread book one. By the time book four has come out, I've read book one 4 times, book two 3 times, and sort of this diminishing return, just so that I can get the previously in this series. So I love it when publishers, I know Bain Books does this, and obviously Joe Monte is doing this at Saga Press, come out with a series within a reasonable span.
Right, and I was very interested to see how many readers are approving that idea. They seem to really, really like, I mean, I've had a couple of people say, oh, the third one's out in November, I'll buy all three then.
Wow.
But the other, some, I guess it's innovative. You probably know better than me.
If you wait till November, then people should buy a box set. But
they should. Well, no, just go buy the books now.
Yeah, it's just a great way to gift the books.
I was going to say, though, the other interesting thing that Saga has done is that they have simultaneously released the books in hardcover, mass market paperback, and ebook.
Now, that's interesting. So do you know the metrics? Do you know how these have...
I don't know the metrics, but, I mean, what I like about it, the hardcover, you know, was intended primarily for library sales and then collectors.
Mm.
And then the paperback would be for people who just want a book to read, as opposed to the ebook.
Right.
And to me, it makes total sense.
It does.
I don't pretend to understand the ways of publishing, but to have a hardcover come out with all the publicity and yet, you know, a $25 price on it.
Yeah.
And then by the time the paperback comes out, are people going to remember that that's the book they wanted to buy back when they weren't ready to spend $25 or $30 on the hardcover?
Right. So, and it can be so long between one and the next.
Yeah. So
I'm fascinated by putting out all three at once. There is a difference with the ebook edition, and I have to admit that while I am a great believer in print, and apparently, according to the New York Times, print is actually making a bit of a comeback, and ebooks, just a slight rise, and ebooks, interestingly, a slight dip, so that it's the same buyers, they're just moving from one medium to another. But this tells us print is not going away anytime soon, I'm very happy to say. Having said that, I love having my phone or tablet or reading device. It may, you know, when I lift up my little phone here, I've got thousands of books on that one device. But I don't enjoy it as much.
See, my backstory is that I had a hardcover copy of The Silmarillion.
Uh-huh.
And I picked that up one day to reread it, and I opened it up, and I got a face full of mildew. The pages had just mildewed.
Oh, my.
And so that book went out in the trash, and that pretty much ended my romance with print books. These days...
And yet that's a very good example of a book in which the print is easier in some ways for what was intended, because it's a book of notes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book of background material rather than a novel with an arc to mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, I did actually replace that in print.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Yeah, but these days, most of my fiction I read is in ebook. I really like ebooks.
Yeah.
But if it's nonfiction, research books, I have learned very quickly to buy the print version. Much easier to mark spots, to take notes,
mm-hmm.
to keep track of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought of playing with the ebook medium? When this first started happening and people were writing their books in HTML, of all things, you know, in the language of the web, you were able to have links to other things. Mm-hmm. And there were some people, one of the earliest with interactive fiction, as it used to be called, Tom Dish wrote an interactive fiction story called Amnesia, which could have any number of different outcomes in different ways. And since you're a hard science fiction writer primarily,
mm-hmm.
I wonder if this ever occurred to you.
Not so much, for different reasons. First, I have hard enough time with one plot. I can't imagine trying to write multiple plots of the same story.
Or multiple resolutions.
Multiple resolutions.
Or different
right.
roads to get to the same mm-hmm. place.
And then, I mean, I've seen like at least one multimedia story. I think Sean Stewart has been doing that for a while. He's done a couple of them.
Yeah.
And I know I got my, what was it, Kathy's story? I think I got that one for my daughter to look at, and she had a great time with that.
Uh-huh.
But I think that almost takes a team to execute. That's a little beyond
I think it does.
My reach.
I think you're right about that.
Mm-hmm. That involved phone numbers, 800 numbers, different sorts of clues, mm-hmm. I guess websites. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different form. It really is. It's one that was never fully explored. And there were a few companies that were playing with it, and then graphics sort of ruined it all. When computers and books and everything were textual, it was a much more interesting adventure to play with.
Mm-hmm.
And when the great video games were all adventure games being written by people like Douglas Adams, who did a couple, and all that. But as graphics came in, that sort of went away, and the writers went back to straight prose.
Mm-hmm. And straight prose is what I can do. You know, when uh-huh. you start bringing images in, that's a whole different ball game there. That's takes a different, completely different skill.
Yeah. Oh, and there have been a couple of people, though, that actually started in adventure game writing,
mm-hmm.
and made their way into prose. Naomi Novik, for example, did Neverwinter Nights and some other adventure game before she ever sold a book
mm-hmm.
or a story. Mm-hmm. And
there's so many ways into this industry. It's, everybody's got their own path.
I think
that's a... One thing to keep in mind is
mm-hmm.
you never know what's going to open the door.
But it's interesting because we're talking about the stigmata for a while of self-publishing
mm-hmm.
that's now becoming more accepted. And yes, it's still a problem how to tell the good from the bad. But very clearly at this point, you are a name brand. You are a known writer with all kinds of awards and awareness behind your name. When Ellen Datlow wrote me, oh yes, thank you, Ellen, and said, Jim, would you like to interview Linda Nagata? It's like, duh.
Well, thank you.
And
thanks to Ellen, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and so obviously that stigmata is... The good stuff comes through, I think. I think it does rise to the top, and you're certainly proof of that.
Well, it takes a lot of promotion either way.
Oh, God, yes.
Yes, I mean, whether you're whether you're self-publishing or traditional publishing. That's
publishers don't do that much promotion anymore, do they? The time was that I could interview somebody and they were on tour.
Tour, what's that?
Yeah, yeah. Right, exactly. but people used to be sent around. I would get phone calls from publishers or mail, before this email, saying such and such will be in New York on a given date.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want time with that person? And now they all, writers have to do it themselves pretty much.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen a few authors who have been going out on tours, but I don't know anybody.
Yeah, but what's also replaced that though is the blog.
Mm-hmm.
That people will blog in other people's blog sites.
Now that
and
I've
stuff.
Done, yeah. That,
yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that can be very helpful. Yes.
Yeah, and it's a good way to cross promote.
Mm-hmm.
You have your blog. It's not extremely active, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, my blog is just very personal. Usually things I've been doing or, notes about the books, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of gotten to the point where I can refer back into the blog to see what happened a few months ago. Where right. was that reviewed again? And it'll be on the blog. So, but it's got, little adventures. Like, I think when I first got here, I was telling you that I had gotten home from my last trip, and I had discovered one of my trees in the yard blooming, and there was a little bird in that tree, and that bird was a native species, native to Maui, that I had never, ever seen in our yard before.
A honey creeper?
A honey creeper,
yes. I've actually heard of them. I don't know lots about them.
Uh-huh.
But
and it was just very, very exciting. So little adventure stories like that wind up on my blog.
Yeah, and well, they should. and well, they should.
Yeah. Occasional thoughts on writing and just what's going on with the books, what's been published.
So how do you think getting read and getting that as a trilogy now through Saga Press, how do you think that's going to change your writing? Are you still going to self-publish, or are you going to go the more, now that you have a brand name publisher, Simon & Schuster, ultimately behind you, and Joe Mahaty has been very successful with what's in essence a new imprint. It's under 2 years old, I'm not quite sure.
Well, their first book came out last January, I believe, January or February.
Wow, that recent, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I knew that Joe had started a while ago when he stopped being an agent.
Mm-hmm. The prep work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. He was at the Barry Goldblatt agency, literary mm-hmm. agency, and he went from there straight to Saga Press.
Mm-hmm.
And he, so how is, do you envision this changing your path?
Well, I think it depends. I've always, pretty much always written on spec. So I'll write a novel and then see if we can sell it. That's been the general way that I've gone. So I think that's what's gonna happen now. I've started on another novel, haven't really spent nearly enough time on it in the last few months, but I at least have it all up here.
Right.
All in my head. Which is not true. I never have a clue what these novels are going to wind up to be until they're actually done. But anyway, I have one underway. And once that's done, we'll sit back and take a look at it and see what looks like the best path for it.
Is this more military style?
This one is, yes. It's another near future, kind of a military background. Seemed to me kind of logical to follow the three books with something relatively similar and take advantage of, if they did well, to take advantage of whatever audience they've earned and give them something else. Over my career, I've tended to vary widely in what I write.
Yes.
I feel like almost this pendulum swinging far future, near future,
mm-hmm.
some hard science fiction, magic-laden fantasy. So maybe a little more consistency for once might be a good idea. So that's...
Maybe, but you see, I like the variety because to me, it's all one genre, and that genre is Linda Nagata.
You sound like my agent.
Well, good.
Reading this book, and he says, but what's going to make it a Linda Nagata book? And I'm like, I don't know.
The fact that she wrote it is what I would say. To me, the name on the cover is enough to make me want to read that.
Well, thank you.
But that's the point of view of a reader, of any reader, is I've read this person before, I will read it again. I'm not going to say, oh, this is fantasy. Instead, I'll say, ooh, I wonder what this person's fantasy will be like, which is what I've been thinking throughout this interview. Because all that I've read of you is pretty hard science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to ask, where did the military fiction come from? Is there something in your background?
There's nothing in my background, per se. People have asked me this question quite a bit. I've never been in the military. My husband has never been in the military. That said, you know, we've been at war. The United States has been at war for quite a long time now.
Yeah.
It's very much, you know, front and
center.
We
have several wars going on right
yes.
now, including a cyber war.
In our consciousness. And my son was in the military. My son-in-law was in the military.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how much that influenced it, but, you know, there was that. But basically where this came from is that I wrote a story that was published in Asimov's, and the character in there just is almost a throwaway background element.
Mm-hmm.
They're a bunch of teenage kids, they're talking to each other, and in this very near future world, if you mess up in your academics, much of the time, going into the military was your option.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something to be absolutely avoided in the socioeconomic level of my character.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the story, this character did not want to go away. He needed to be involved in more stories, and he became the protagonist of The Red. And I knew first that I just wanted to write more of his story, and I had no idea at that point what I was going to do. And I just went back and looked over that short story, and it was just like light breaking. Oh, he is going to wind up in the army.
Okay.
And that's basically where that
came. So it's
from.
Really character driven.
Character driven.
Yes. Which is, I think, what makes it, to me, compelling.
Mm-hmm.
That it's character driven rather than let's write a military story. There are some writers I can name who write primarily military, and they don't really care about the characters. They care about the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a slush pile reader. I mentioned I cut my teeth on things like Galaxy. I was at Galaxy magazine,
mm-hmm.
reading for Jim Bain, of all people.
Wow, okay.
Who was the penultimate editor. There was one more person, I forget who it is, who laid Galaxy to rest. Pardon me. But Bain, the entire staff at that point was Jim Bain, Spider Robinson, and I was the flunky. And there were certain rules that we had, and people will be surprised to hear this, because this is Jim Bain and not Bain Publishing, which does a lot of military science fiction. A lot of it's superior to other publishers. But rule number one is you open the manuscript and the first words are, aye, aye, sir, go to the next manuscript. That one didn't get a handwritten note. Sorry, that was a thank you so much. Better luck in another market.
Yeah, okay, that's probably not your best opening line.
Yeah, but it was, there was also a point to that.
Symptomatic of the rest of the story?
It usually, unless it was a comedy, mm-hmm. a satire, or something like that. You know, Harry Harrison might have done something with that and could carry it further. But if this was somebody who had read simply, you know,
every word Jerry Pournelle had ever published and just wanted to be in that military that Pournelle had created.
Mm-hmm.
That was symptomatic of bad fiction. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad military science fiction out there. And there's some very good.
There is some very good fiction out there. So, I had not read widely amongst military science fiction when I wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
I just, what I knew was I wanted it to reflect the U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to base it on that as opposed to basing it on traditional military fiction tropes.
Yeah, which is why some of that is a little closer to our future.
Our time. It's very time. Near future. Yeah.
It's very near future.
And it was also deliberately written to possibly work as a genre crossover. So just military adventure fiction as well as military science fiction.
Okay. And it's been well received.
It's been well received, yes.
Yeah.
Very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the stigmata of a woman writing military fiction is dissipating finally? Because there are several women who have written decent military science fiction, and some men who have written some credible women protagonists in military science fiction.
Yeah, I agree with
David
that.
David Weber comes to
mind. Right, but I think the difference is that a lot of the women who are successful at it are writing space opera, from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not space opera by any stretch of the imagination.
This is not the CJ Cherry.
This is a military thriller. And it could be easily described as that without the science fiction element. So it's so near future that I think it's not really in that same kind of genre that women have been succeeding at. In fact, I had this conversation with my agent because the plan was to market it outside the genre,
mm-hmm.
in part. And, you know, I remember asking him, but are any women writing in that genre? And he's like, none that I know of. So I don't know.
Well, I'm aware that there are some women who are writing in that genre under pseudonyms.
Okay.
And they are otherwise science fiction writers, but occasionally, I won't divulge the great secret, although actually at a couple of conventions I've heard these women divulge it themselves, so. But I'll leave it to them to do so.
Yeah, that was a debate in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point in my career, you know, I could try a pseudonym, and I've certainly considered doing that. But then what do I do with all the readers who actually do want to read my books?
Yes, exactly.
So,
because that's my case. I am more interested in reading. I don't go out and look for military science fiction. Mm-hmm. It's not my preferred genre. But I've read your stuff. I'm familiar with you in at least a couple of styles of or subgenres of your writing. And so I'm willing to take the military science fiction because you wrote it.
Uh-huh.
More so than the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to think the stigmata is changing as society is hopefully becoming more inclusive.
I would like to think so. I'm not convinced yet that that really is the case.
I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah.
But I think the openings have begun. What, outside of what you're working on now, since you have done hard science fiction, magical fantasy, long form, short form, military based speculative fiction, I think is a good way to put that. What areas would you like to touch upon, land down, play with?
I like writing very near future. As the saying goes, we live in a science fiction world. There is just so much going on, so much under development, and it's just completely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the red. A lot of the technology in there involves things that are happening now. They're being developed now.
Yeah.
And
some of them may even be there now, and we're not fully aware of it.
Yeah, and I was actually writing the book thinking, write faster before this stuff gets, you know, is passé already.
Yeah.
So it doesn't...
I think William Gibson once said, the future is passé, which I thought was just a wonderful quote.
And I'm just fascinated by that. So that's what I see myself working on in the immediate future, is books that are set in this world that we live in,
mm-hmm.
and exploring some ramifications or, you know, possible outcomes of the sorts of technology and the social systems and political systems that that we actually live with.
So it truly is speculative fiction in a way rather than science fiction, because we're dealing with imagining what we have, where we're going, stuff that is currently under development.
Yes, that sounds like a good definition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why the term speculative fiction is such a fun catch-all. And I always like to point out to listeners, people who think, oh, they've only heard the term spec fic in like the last 15, 20 years, and they think that it's something relatively new. And I love to remind people, was coined in 1946 by Robert Heinlein.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't. It was in a guest of honor speech that he gave at some convention. Then he wrote a piece in Astounding. And it's that, I think the convention was 46 and the publication was in 47. And that's where the term comes from.
Hmm.
So... before anybody makes too many... I think that's great. I think that's wonderful, because he is another person who dealt with many different genres, although very little near fiction, very near future.
Mm-hmm.
That was an area that he did not really deal with.
Interesting. Yeah, as I said, I've written far future and mid future, and now... Mm-hmm. Yeah, now it's...
So you sort of started way out, as it were, and bringing stuff closer to
I've gone back and forth, really. My second novel basically started now.
Yes.
And that would have been 15 years ago.
Right.
It's like I think of it as pendulum swinging from far off in time to close in time. It's like mm-hmm. I shouldn't say this, but I get easily bored. So if I've done the far future, I'm like, okay, I'm over that. Let's go do something completely different.
Yeah, well, people, artists go through periods, you know, mm-hmm. Picasso had the blue period, the cubist period, and all that. Writers have that as well. Certainly Philip K. Dick did. He had... stories of certain structures, or perhaps lack thereof in some cases. And you could tell that there was the what is the real human being era, and the religious, I'll refrain from the religious explorations era. And he was just starting another great era. I think he was getting better again when he died. Sadly, but I think that people do that. I think that they go through periods. They're artists. You're an artist.
It was interesting because, you know, I did the nanotech books that was in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and then didn't touch it again until I think it was 2010, 2011, and I decided I needed to write some short fiction. So I sat down one day and took a background character out of my first novel and started to write a series of stories from his point of view. And the first of those was called Nahiku West, and that was published in Analog.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on to be, was it runner-up, I think, for, I believe it was a Philip K. Dick Award for mm-hmm. short fiction. Yeah, so, but it was an interesting experience to go back and write again in that story world. You know, it wasn't exactly the same world because I had started earlier in the timeline,
mm-hmm.
but it was easier than I thought to re-immerse in that, for that one. So I've done two stories in that series, and I'm hoping to do one to two more one of these days.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about collections of stories?
Well, I did my story collection as part of my self-publishing.
Right.
What I did is I had the rights back on my first six novels. So I did all of those as ebooks. I republished them all as ebooks. Those mm-hmm. are available for Mythic Island Press LLC. That's me. And I did most of them as print-on-demand books, so they can be purchased in print or ebook. But then I decided I had these short stories that were not available anywhere.
Yeah.
And I had 10 of them. So I just put them together in a collection. And that includes Goddesses, which is...
Now, that was a big breakthrough story for you, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Best novella?
Best novella for the Nebulas.
Yeah.
And that was...
Which is a big deal, by the way. I, for one, not discussing any of the politics that have gone on this year with the Hugos, I have always pointed out that the Hugos are a fanish popularity contest. The Nebulas is a peer award. You have to be a published writer to vote.
To vote for them, right?
Yeah. And mm-hmm. to me, somebody getting a Nebula, that is a mark of distinction.
Well, this was purchased by Ellen Datlow and when she was editing sci-fi.com.
Sci-fiction,
yes. And this was it 2000? I think it was published in 2000.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, so it was an online story, which was a really rare beast back in those days.
Scifiction.com was ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
It really was. And before that, she had EventHorizon.com. That talk about something that really... This is just when Omni finally folded. Omni went from magazine to Omni.com. To that went away, and Ellen, with a couple of other people, started Event Horizon, which nobody knew how to monetize it. The idea of making money on the web didn't really exist. We're talking about, I don't know, it's 96, 97.
We're still trying to figure that one out.
Yeah. Well, some websites have certainly done it. You do it through ebooks, you do it through... publishing hardcover, not hardcover, hard print editions
mm-hmm.
Of the magazine. This is something that Lightspeed does,
mm-hmm.
and Clark's World, and the good ones. They are making money. They're doing quite well, in fact. So somebody figured it out. But Scifiction, that was a very sad story because they were publishing some great stuff. I think the year, but the problem is they were owned by NBC, basically, and whoever owned NBC at the time, I think it was Universal, Vivendi, and they didn't quite get it. They only saw things in very, very, very big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they owned the Sci-Fi Channel, and didn't know, actually I think they still do, and didn't know what to do with it to the point where they changed the name of the channel. They closed Scifiction. The very year that they closed Scifiction, I think Datlow had like six stories nominated between Hugos and Nebulas and several winners in there. it was at the top of the heap, as it were,
mm-hmm.
for a magazine getting professional recognition for quality of stories, and they closed it that same year.
Wow. Yeah. I just remember being thrilled that Ellen wanted to buy a story of mine. That was my first sale to her. Yeah.
Yeah. And so mm-hmm. that stigma, and that's, I think, also where that stigmata also goes away. If you're publishing your own stuff, but I also know that your stuff has been in Asimov's or a Dadlow anthology, if not, you know, and she's buying now for Tor.com.
Mm-hmm.
And or Lightspeed or Clark's World or this or that, the market has sort of reopened again, and that informs me of who the good writers are.
In the short fiction, you use that as a recommendation for.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I advise that to a lot of people. Is take a look at, there are so many best of the year anthologies now, mm-hmm. and there isn't a bad one that I'm aware of, and very, very good editors. And you take a look at who got in there and at the honorable mentions.
Mm-hmm.
They all do honorable mentions. And this is how you will find out the names of writers. Then they have a book. And if you like the long form, now you know what books to buy.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. That's the one of the reasons I started writing short stories again. I had not written any short fiction since Goddesses, and that was...
Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that.
And so finally, actually it was a couple of my readers who showed up on my blog and started lecturing me. You should write more short fiction. Okay. So
I did.
And then I found actually that I never used to really like to write short fiction. It was too hard. Took me too long
for the returns.
And then once I started again, like I said, I think it was around 2010 or 11, and I wrote maybe 10 stories over the next 2 or 3 years, and I just enjoyed it so much more than I had before.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I said that was one of my favorite questions, and there was a time when I was working for Dadlow as an online interviewer. And every week I would ask that same question, short form versus long form. And in the private chat channel, Ellen would be saying, "Not again! Don't ask that again!" But I would, and I did, and I do it still in interviews. And one of these years, I'm going to try to find all the different interviews I've done where I've asked this question
mm-hmm.
and edit people's answers together into one thing that explores the different forms. And it is harder, I think, to write good short fiction than a novel. This is what I've taken out of this question.
Yeah, I think part of it's the returns question. I think I did programming for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
and I really liked programming. And in some ways, it was like writing a novel in that it would involve all these pieces that would come together, and they'd have to make something workable.
Mm-hmm.
But with programming, we always had a fixed endpoint. You knew if it was working or not.
Mm-hmm.
And
once you got it debugged. Yeah.
Right. Whereas you don't never have that certainty with a novel or a short fiction for that matter. And so there's always this question of, well, you know, I like what I'm doing, but will anybody else like it? And with a novel, you can keep answering that question, so to speak, by you add more things to it, you add more layers into it as you go over and over it again. And with short fiction, it can be much the same, but at the end of it, you've got 20 pages as opposed to something that's much more marketable at 400 pages, which seems like an odd thing to say, but that's how the industry works.
Yeah, no, that is exactly how it works. And it is more marketable because, A, short fiction doesn't pay that much.
Mm-hmm.
B, people tend not to remember the name of the writer. It's not. It doesn't help brand the writer as much as a novel does.
Mm-hmm. But I will have to say, for short fiction, it's a great way to toy with ideas, to take them on test runs. So, like I was saying earlier, The Red is based on this short story called Through Your Eyes that was published in Asimov.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also based on another short story called Nightside on Callisto.
Oh, okay, that one I know.
Yeah, that was published at Lightspeed. And then one is basically at the very beginning of the
timeline.
Before
my time, but I knew that one, yeah.
Yeah, and then the Nightside on Callisto is basically beyond the reach of this trilogy. It's in the future of it. Mm-hmm. But it helped define the world that I was working on. And so the only reason this novel exists is because I wrote these two seemingly unrelated short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And after I finished them, I just suddenly realized that they very well could be the same story world, and now they are.
And there was the connective tissue from one story to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So you've built a universe.
Yep.
Really, that you can play with.
Yep.
And you're going to continue in that universe for a while, even though...
I actually don't have plans right now to do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I know when I wrote... The first one I wrote was Nightside on Callisto, and
right.
that included... The Red. And I won't go any farther than that. But I will say that as soon as I finished that story, I just had this feeling that this was my next story world that I was going to be working in.
Mm-hmm.
It was very exciting at the time. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it. I just thought that this is trying to tell me something. And so, yeah, I wound up writing the novels, and I've got, I think, two other stories that I've written since in that story world.
Oh, okay.
In fact, you probably know one. One was codenamed Delphi.
That oh, yes.
That was a Lightspeed story.
Yes, that was one I worked on.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first story that I did for Lightspeed where I got to play with special effects. You don't want to do too much in the way of special effects, but there were a number of characters on walkie-talkies in that particular story because there's a woman who's controlling the different characters out there. And so just a little bit of... this in the background, just to vary it.
I
hope you know. My announcing for that was awful. I did two of your stories. The first one, I'm almost ashamed of.
Oh.
And the second one, I'm very pleased with.
Oh, good, good.
And that was this past April.
Oh, The Way Home.
Yes.
That's a fantasy story.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. That's a military fantasy story.
It is a very interesting military fantasy story that invokes a lot of what we've been reading about with desert-based. That's not male-based, is it? The Way Home. As I recall.
Not what?
Not male. The protagonist.
Is a man. Yeah.
It is a man. Okay. I'm getting stories confused in my head.
Yep.
This is because I haven't slept much. It's a Thursday. I was up till 6 a.m.
Mm-hmm. Well.
So,
we'll let it go.
I'm running hyper and lightheaded.
Yeah. The Way Home is, it's more of a portal story.
Mm-hmm.
In that there's not any...
Actually, maybe that's the one we'll play with this interview.
Ah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not base... It doesn't have magic per se. The characters don't wield magic.
Right.
Put it that way. They just have to deal with the circumstances they find themselves in.
Right.
And they have to find the way home, which is the title of the story.
Right.
Right, okay.
And now I'm remembering it a little bit better. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Three stories every 2 weeks. So it's a lot of output. Mm-hmm. I received three today.
Wow.
And I'm working on three novels at the same time. So it's a lot of editing that I get to do on them, but it's tremendous fun. It really is. So I guess this is sort of, again, I'm thinking of having the Saga Press books come out with the Red Trilogy, which is that a good way to...
We call it the Red Trilogy.
Calling it that. Mm-hmm. Okay, there you go. And in fact, they're all available at this point on Amazon. You can pre-order.
Pre-order, right.
Yeah.
The third book will be out November 3rd, but it can be pre-ordered.
Yeah, mm-hmm. At this time. It's available
mm-hmm.
for purchase.
Yes.
And isn't there a snippet of it, in fact, available?
I'm sure there is at Amazon, but
yeah.
There is at my website as well.
Right. Okay. Yes. Very good. And your website, again, is?
MythicIsland.com.
Okay. And we should probably spell that out for people again.
Okay. It's probably easiest to find by searching my name.
Okay.
But it's spelled MythicIsland, Island, ISLAND, .com.
Okay. The best portal to all of your stuff is to simply search on your name.
Yes.
And find the Wikipedia entry, find your blog site, and...
You know, my website and my blog are different, but they will lead one to the other.
Right.
And information on the books is just basically the front page of my website will give you almost everything you need.
So, okay.
Yeah.
What have you thought at all about adaptations? Selling... Since we're dealing with near future stuff, this is all very filmable or televisionable, screenable. I think that's a good word.
Yes.
Screenable.
Yes.
Since that's a form that's changing as well.
Mm-hmm. I would love it to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we're not there yet.
Yeah.
That's in my agent's hands. So.
Okay. So knock wood.
Yeah.
So we should probably start wrapping up. What haven't we discussed that you would like to?
I think we've covered most of the recent work, and let's see. There's not a lot left.
Okay, so...
We've gone over most of it at this point.
So, yeah. You know, to wrap up again, we're talking with Linda Nagata. N-A-G-A-T-A, simple to spell, as you said, but again, it's radio,
mm-hmm.
and you like to spell that out, and it's L-I-N-D-A. There are people who use a Y in there for whatever reason, and there's a lot of good stuff to be had. I hadn't really realized until I was preparing for the interview how much of your stuff was done on your own, because I knew you through... the more mainstream, if one can call it that, places, like Asimov's and...
Well, I mean, what's been done on my own is basically what was originally published by traditional publishers.
Right.
So now all of that is under my own imprint. So I've republished all of the first 6 books and then created my own collection of stories, which had originally been published in the traditional magazines.
So that's really wonderful that mm-hmm. you have this self-built business of your own fiction going. That's mm-hmm. something that could not have existed 10 years ago.
No, and the interesting thing is that I remember even in the 90s thinking how I would love to republish these books on my own.
Yeah.
And I just woke up one day and realized that I actually could do that. I had actually been learning InDesign just so I could republish my 4th novel, Vast. I wanted that one back.
Oh, God, that was a good book.
Thank you. I wanted that back in print for its 10th anniversary, and I didn't make that, but by the time print-on-demand became doable, I pretty much knew how to do a book layout. I taught myself that a few years earlier.
And you've done it well from what I've seen. There are some people who don't. but that's a different route and a different conversation
mm-hmm.
for another time. But I do hope that you get back to New York, and either Ellen or I will have you do a reading. Because Ellen runs the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series. I am her, we're not competition. I am her sister reading series with the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings that I produce.
Well, I'll have to give you more notice next time.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it was an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you. So I am.
Well, and it was quite a pleasure. Vast. When I reacted to her mentioning Vast, thematically that wasn't the first of her works at all, of course, but it was, I think, the first that I had read, and it just blew me away. And let me tell you that there stands a very good chance that her work will do the same for you. So, again, the person who we listened to that interview was from September of 2015, and the person I was speaking with is Linda Nagata, Nagata, from Hawaii in the United States, and quite a wonderful writer and fascinating person. And her last novel, The Last Good Man, is just recently out as a Publisher's Weekly starred review. And to visit her website, you can go to mythicisland.com, M-Y-T-H-I-C, island.com. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I am Jim Freund, and we are in our umpteenth year of Hour of the Wolf. I guess we're in our 46th year, believe it or not, is when Margot Adler began this program, and I was involved in the program at the beginning, but clearly it was her show, and she established initially Thursdays and Fridays were the science fiction mornings, and Mondays she would have, and I was the co-host, and Mondays she would have occasionally different co-hosts, people like Neil Conan and Mike Odell, who later went out to our L.A. station, became the news director there, as Margot was the weekend news director here in New York until Hour of the Wolf. And, well, that's a whole other story. I've told it before, and I will tell it again, but not necessarily this morning. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I don't have anything specific to say other than once again to urge you to come tonight, that is to say Thursday night, to the, as I mentioned at the end of that interview, and oh God, do I hope that, what I really want is, I want Linda Nagata, who I've had on the show but never had read, and Kate Elliott, who I've had read but never had on the show, and I want them both to read together because they're the two best science fiction writers in Hawaii, plain and simple, in the whole state of Hawaii. I don't know what islands each of them are from, but that's where they are. And good stuff from each of them. I dare say they're at a different kind of thing. By the way, if you're more into short stories and into novels, Linda has a collection of short stories called Light and Shadow. If you have something relevant to the world of science fiction and fantasy, and I mean really relevant, truly relevant. We have a few minutes left, and we'll take phone calls at area code 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. And let's see, what is it that I myself might discuss? I finally did see the last episode of American Gods, last episode of the first season, which takes you maybe a quarter of the way through the book. That's all it goes. But it is nevertheless very entertaining. And that, I would say, of the eight episodes of the first season, I'd say only three are actually directly of the book. But the rest of the stories and the tales that are told within this spread out universe, this road trip novel, the new ones that have been created by Brian Fuller and co-director are dead on perfect. And outside of the fact that the very first episode, there is absolutely needless gore. Outside of that, I had no problems with it. And last week, Terrence Taylor said that in the eighth episode is a big, big spoiler. And there's not a spoiler in there, I promise you. Saw the end of this season of Doctor Who until Christmas, and I have to say, I was very disappointed. I really was. This is the end of one of the best Doctors they've ever had. They should have written better for him. Ah, well. Good morning. You are on the radio. Hello? I believe I am...
Town and emergency.
There we are. Yeah, Robert, just, why is it always you?
Well, I didn't know you. I was about to fall asleep, although I did enjoy the interview with Linda Nagata.
Yeah.
I must say, coming from, by the way, I refer to it as the Kingdom of Hawaii for historical purposes, and I would love to know if she ever comes to New York again and she does a live reading, if she has ever delved into matters Polynesian. But anyway, my question
the
to
answer,
you.
The answer, I can pretty much answer the that no.
No. Okay. What gods were covered, if you don't mind telling me? I had to go out of town on an emergency. So what gods were covered in the last episode? Or what gods were we introduced to?
That would be a spoiler.
Oh. Okay.
One that predates... Oh, okay. I'll tell you the name of one. For Christ's sake. Jesus.
Oh?
But there's many, many, many of them because there are so many different ways that so many people recognize Jesus.
Oh.
And he doesn't say anything. There are just many of him all over the place. But he is there because he supplanted a different god. And it is that god who is the spoiler.
Okay. Well,
and
all
it's
right.
one—it's one that would probably amuse you a great deal, because it's one who people don't think of. Why are you laughing?
No.
There's nothing funny here.
No, okay. I'm not laughing at you.
It's—I didn't think you were laughing at me. It's,
No. I'm sorry.
You ask a question, I'm answering it. It's not a joke.
Okay.
It's a god who has been associated with Jesus, but people don't even realize that this is a god. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And predates Jesus by 2,000 years.
Getting an idea.
So I'll leave it at that.
No, I understand. You don't want to give a spoiler. All right, have a great reading tonight. Will you be on the air next week, or is that ReaderCon?
I will be at ReaderCon next week. Don't know if I'll be on the air or not.
Okay. Good night.
Okay. Take care. Yeah, so, Lister, you want to do the show next week? Is that, that's an okay. So no, I will not be on the air next week. Lister will be here. And after that comes the thon, doesn't it? Yeah. So, you know, all hell breaks loose at that point. Who knows if Lister or I, or Lister and I, will be on the air. Thons are unpredictable things, as is life at WBAI in general. Yeah, indeed.
That's why I don't wear a thong on the beach. You know what I
mean? Yeah, yeah. There you go. Well, no, that's very predictable.
Yes.
No, no thong Lister. The man writes thongs, he produces thongs, but he won't wear them. But that's just if you have a lisp. Sigh. Okay. Now I'm just in a mood this morning, in case people can't tell. What is this device here?
What's the
one that says, do not touch, do not touch. What is that?
No idea.
It blinks. It says, I'm going to take a photo of it. I'm going to post it.
Looks like Pacifica.
Well, yeah. I'm going to post it and... thank you, Gordon. I just got last week's KGB readings. It was a really good one. It was Kat Valenti and Sonny Moraine, both of whom I'll be seeing next week at ReaderCon.
It's an extra fee to a monitor.
Well, is it? Because the headphones are fine. The so-called live monitor is so terribly quiet. You can barely hear it. So it went from roaring to silent. That's typical of here. One second. Where did I put my camera app? There it is. Yeah, everybody uses their camera app first thing. And I'm just going to take a photo of that. And I'll post it later on Facebook and or Twitter. And I should take a picture of the console so people can see just how crude. You know, it's like I have been here.
Would you like a beer can to put next to it so they can see the relativity?
No, it's just a small mixing board is what it is. It's not a broadcast console by any means. You know, it just doesn't really count. So I am going to slowly wend my way out of here. So once again, tonight, at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, we will have Paul Witkover, who will also be the guest curator, and Rachelene Maltese. And I promise you, I absolutely, utterly promise you, that you will have a good time. If you come, it's 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. Donations accepted. And
what time?
We begin at 7 o'clock. We suggest that you show up about 6:30 so you can grab yourself a nice table and a bit of food and meet the other nice people who are going to be there as well. And it is streamed live, and not just audio. This is a video stream. It's practically a professional TV show, thanks to Terrence Taylor. And what you do is you go to live stream, and then you search on live stream for either Brooklyn Commons or NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, and you will see a lot of the readings we've done, but the one that's coming up, that will be the one that you can watch. By the way, if you have, so you can watch this on any phone, any computer, or a Roku device. All of those carry live stream. So, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. Lister will be extending Burn Baby Burn Clappers next week. And we'll be starting at 1 a.m. and he'll be on from 1 to 5. And I got to tell you, having a little time to, like, you know, stretch out a little, that makes for better radio. Got to tell you, it really does. It really does. So, with all that said, and hopefully this was good radio for you this morning, you can visit me on Facebook as Jim Freund, or join the Hour of the Wolf group, or join the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group, or join the WBAI radio group. I'm at all of them. So, and you can send me email, jim@ourwolf.com. Oh, there's all kinds of ways to not get rid of me. Have a good week. Have a good 2 weeks. Take good care of yourselves. Take good care of others, because we all deserve it. We deserve to take care of people, and we deserve to be taken care of by those we love and who love us. And that should be universal. That's all I gotta say. Good morning, and take good care. Stay tuned.
From the fastest, and watch me burn that piece up to ashes, 'cause the real meaning is what the message slur. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Number one.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Give me a choice, oh gosh. This little foreign boy, I bit my heart rejoice. What kind of something this? Me love your style, me love your flow. You're really romantic. Me love the fact that you're musically artistic like me. Him say, please, please, me I beg you a chance, Katie. But I really had to hesitate, because him live in New York City, me live in Jamaica. True, I really like you, I'm gonna show you a piece of the island ways when you touch a Jamaica. When my pass through the place and feel the island breeze, when him kiss my lips, it's sweet like honey from the bees. I love him, island girls. They give me to me, island girls. And when we touch it at the kitchen, and the food are the sweet. I'm off to go back up foreign because my package complete. I am your island girl. sit down on the baseline. Heart in your hand, I did so me prefer for place mine. That's why it's hard to get me off in mine. I am black, strong and educated too. Best of the best, I am related to. That's why the little foreign juve stick to me like glue. Send me puzzling money, my tribe for find the clues. When my purse through the place and feel the island breeze. When them kiss my lips, it's sweet like honey from the bees. I'm loving islanders. They give me to me islanders. And when my touch it at the kitchen, and the food all go sweet. Now I fi go back up foreign and because me package complete. I am Miss Islander.
And drums, with the one and the all that come. Don't you know that the time has come to ring the alarm undone, undone. Remember the life before. Every mother was a little bit of another brother lost at war. And the family he left home, a wife and a baby and alone. A flag and a medal and a tomb. A general in every living room. And a television telling you to to hate everybody but you. But it doesn't have to be that way. I remember back in the day, when we used to say, okay, give a hand to somebody else. It's your ticket out of hell. Unring that bell. Unring that bell. Get out of hell, and heaven will surely know. Like a bomb in harmony, summer heat. My back is sticking to me to the seat. Bare feet, tank top, and shorts is all you need. But summer breeze, I'm feeling kind of fine. I'm rolling with my shorty all the time. Wine and grind, lovely shit.